Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good to see you. My name is Billy Cervini. I'm obviously a priest, and I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. It's been great. We've been here. It's myself, my wife, Sharla, my son, Wiley, and Emmy. We are so happy to be here. We've been looking forward to this for a long time, and thank you for the beautiful weather. This is a real special thing for me. I was here last year, but prior to that, I'd spent a lot of years in Linville. My father was the Episcopal Bishop of Florida when I was growing up. So as a boy, I would come up here and we would spend a month at a time, and I'd live in that rectory and everything around here, the smells, stepping in this room, every time I smell, all these memories come flooding back to me, right? You feel the same way, I'm sure, when you've been away, you come back here. I remember stepping here and I remember waking up in that rectory. Or I remember standing in those creeks looking for crawfish, or I remember my father standing in this pulpit. But I also remember my parents' crippling anxiety, worrying that my brother, sister, or I were going to do something that was so embarrassing that we would never be invited back. That was the regular occasion. We drive up here from Jacksonville in my mother's station wagon. I remember we'd be about 10 miles out of town. My mom would turn around and we'd have the talk. I was an impulsive child. Preacher's kid, and she would always say, "Now listen, this is the Isiola Lodge. This is Linville. You cannot drive the golf carts in the creeks. You can't sharpen sticks and go spear fishing for the koi in the koi pond and do stuff like that. You know, it's one of those things. Halos on tight." And I remember coming in the first weeks, I always felt like I kind of had a secret hidden, that I was this rambunctious thing. But you know, like you said, halos on tight. The problem with that is when you put your halo on, we all know what happens with halos. It's just a matter of time before they slip, right? They slip. And I remember they slipped many times for me up here. But I remember one time sitting right on that fence right out front. It was back when that street used to go all the way through. And now it's a dead end, but used to go all the way through. And I remember my parents were sitting up here with a bunch of their friends. And I was sitting there, and for some reason I had a crab apple in my hand. And I will never forget the black Corvette slowly just kind of rubbernecking, walking going down the street. And I thought to myself, I've never had a good throwing arm, but I threw a frozen rope. I mean, it would, and it, boom, exploded on that windshield. And I remember being gathered up in my parents' arms and taken into the rectory. Again, halos slip, don't they? 50 years later, thanks for having me back. I got my back. I appreciate it. Sorry about your car. It's a funny story. We laugh at it. We laugh at it for a few reasons. One, you laugh at it because you probably all had kids, or you've seen how that happens and all those things can unfold. But you also laugh at that because you can relate to it. You can relate to it as an adult, because we all, even as adults, you might not be throwing crab apples at cars, but you can relate to your own version of this, that we all have this secret subplot in our life. We all have this story, or this aspect of our story, that we keep behind the curtain that we don't want people to see because, you know, halo's on tight, right? Best face forward. Here's the thing about us in this room, and this is true for all of us. We have two things in common. First thing we all have in common in this room is that none of us have it all together, right? We can agree with that. And the second thing that we all have in common is we want everyone around us to think we do. Isn't that the truth? And aren't we that way? I know I'm that way. Why is that? I mean, I know why I don't have it all together. I know because, you know, sin, and I'd rather go my own way than God's way, and I can understand why I can be a bit of a train wreck at times. But why is it that I don't want anyone to know that? Why is it that there are things that in our lives we would rather die than let people find out how messy we can actually be? Is it just because we're afraid that we're not going to get invited back? Part of it, I guess. I think it runs deeper than that, though. I love the creation story. And anytime you hear me preach, I always talk about Genesis at some juncture. But the story in Genesis 3, where the first man and the first woman are in the garden, and they eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and sin enters. You know the first thing they did when sin entered? You know what they did? They hid. They went and they ran and they hid in the bushes and they covered themselves. And God came and he walked through the garden, and he was going to have his regular walk with Adam and Eve in the cool of the day. And he calls to them, "Where are you? Adam, where are you?" When God asks a question in the Bible, just so you know, he always knows the answer. And what did he say? He said, Adam, why were you hiding? Adam said, I was hiding. Why were you hiding? He said, I was naked and unashamed. I was naked and ashamed. That's a weird answer. And it's weird for this reason. Adam lived in the garden. There was one rule, just one rule in the garden. Don't eat of this tree. And they had just broken that one rule. So it made sense. Adam, why did you hide? Because I've broken the one rule. That's not what he was saying. What Adam was saying in that moment was, God, I'm not hiding because I've done something wrong. I'm hiding because I am something wrong. There's something broken in me that I can't bear to have you see. Because if you see it, if you saw what I truly was, what I'm truly like, what I really look like, guess what? You would reject me. And I would be forced to just roam the existential darkness of this world. And I would be alone. And that condition of Adam's heart, he passed it to his son, and it passed it to his son, and his children, on down the line. And guess what? We got the same thing. That same bass note that we don't even hear it. It records like a loop in our ears. What's it whisper in our ears? It says, you are something wrong. There's something not right about you. You're not enough. You're invalid. And just like Adam, what do we do in that moment? We want to cover it up. I don't want people to see what I'm like behind closed doors, what my family's like behind closed doors, or the thing that I wrestle with. Because if you saw that, guess what? You'd run out of this room. We would reject each other. At least that's what we're scared of. Problem is this. When we put that good face forward, halos slip, don't they? And it's just a matter of time before someone sees that crab apple behind your back, right? As we carry this anxiety and we live with that thing, what do I do with it? This is where it's beautiful. The gospel that we just read puts its finger right in the middle of this place. Matthew chapter 9. It's this kind of frantic passage. We have like four or five different stories and 10 different people all crashing in at once. It's almost like Matthew was running out of paper and he had to condense it in there. Jesus had just healed a paralytic. He's walking down the street. He sees this guy named Matthew who's a tax collector. He says, hey, Matthew, follow me. Matthew drops everything, follows Jesus, walks. Scene dissolves really quickly. Jesus is sitting at a dinner table and he's sitting with these sinners. We don't know what that means, but we can get a pretty good idea. He's eating with the sinners. The Pharisees come in. They start busting Jesus' chops. Like, why are you eating like this and with these people? And then in the middle of their dinner, this guy, this temple ruler, a guy we learn in another gospel named Jairus, comes in, falls on his face in front of Jesus, says, my daughter is dead. Not dying. She is dead. And will you come and fix this? So Jesus gets up and he's walking out and there's a crowd crushing in on him. And in the middle of the crowd, there's a woman who's been bleeding for 12 years. And she sneaks up behind him and touches Jesus' garment, the hem of his garment. And he stops and he's like a needle off the record moment. He said, who did this? And he comes to her and he says, darling, your faith has made you well. I don't think he said darling, but you know what I mean. He said, your faith has made you well. And he blessed her, and then he goes to Jairus' house, and there's mourners everywhere, and he says, she's just asleep, and they laugh at him, and they kick him out of the house, and then he raises this little girl from the dead. Whew, that's a day. Now, I've been in ministry a long time, but I can't imagine. I read that, I'm like, boundaries, Jesus. Right? What's Matthew doing here? Like, why did he sweep all that together? Because it's kind of hard to follow, right? When you begin to settle into one narrative, you get jumped by another one, and you just see him just hitting these points over and over again. And I think he did that for a reason, and he did that differently than the other gospel writers. Because in this story, Jesus, he wasn't just doing ministry. See, he wasn't just stepping into the lives of people in need, which he certainly was. Jesus was stepping into the most spiritually disqualifying places in these people's lives. Jesus was going to their most broken aspects of their personhood. He was going to the place where they would be rejected. That thing that if someone saw it, that just said, I am something wrong. And what Matthew 9 is, it's this showcase, a display case of failure or brokenness or rejection. You've got Matthew, who's this tax collector, who's a Jewish person who is now partnering with the Roman Empire, which is the occupying army force, betraying his own people and stealing from people, which tax collectors did. Then you have these sinners that he ate at the dinner table with. And again, they don't get into details, but we know in other places they were prostitutes. They were drunkards. I don't know about you, I mean, it's the last time that you had dinner table that looked like that. There were people that were banned from going into the temple. Then you have this woman from bleeding for 12 years. What's do you think she hid that secret? Oh, yes, she did. Do you know why she hid that secret? Because no one could touch her. Because if anyone touched her, they would be ceremonially unclean and couldn't worship in the temple. She couldn't worship in the temple. Can you imagine 12 years of your life and no one touches you? And of course, she didn't have children, so people believe she was cursed with God. And then we have cursed by God. Then we have this little girl who died. She didn't do anything wrong. She just died, right? And she just succumbed to illness. Yes. But in this moment, it's not what she did. It's what she was. Because to a Jewish person, especially a Jewish rabbi, you can never touch a dead thing. To touch a dead thing makes you unclean and it invalidates you here. So there's a couple things I need you to see in this passage here. See, when Jesus is stepping into this thing and he sees these horrific areas in these people's lives, those areas did not recoil Jesus. They're the reason he came. The ground zero of their shame, the most broken places of their story. That is why he was there. That's why he came. For I came not to call the righteous, but the sinners. Why does that matter? Because what was true for them is true for you. It's true for me. We have a Jesus that moves towards us in our brokenness, in our faults, in our failures. And that sounds so cliche because we've been around church so often. We hear that a lot, don't we? But guess what? None of us believe that. I don't believe that. I don't live like that. I live like that sin is something that I have to overcome in order for Jesus to find me attractive. That if I can just be better, then Jesus will get closer. That's the opposite of the way this works. Jesus came for the people that have the apple behind their back, the people that have the story behind their back, and he penetrates those stories. The truth is, you are attractive to Jesus. Period. That's why he's so willing to step into the depth of those places in your life. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. That was long before the cross. It wasn't the cross that made you lovable. Who do you identify with that story? When you read this, like, who is it? What stirs in your heart with that? Is it those sinners that make the obvious mistakes, those whose sins are on a billboard? Is it the tax collector? Is it that cling tightly to the money or the things that they have? Or is it the hemorrhaging woman that you have this secret that you can't let anybody see because it would be so disqualifying, you can't tell anybody? Or maybe it's the little girl who had died and something that's in your life is not your fault. Maybe it's something that happened to you. Or something that you've experienced that you feel like has marked you forever. Or maybe it's the Pharisees. Where it's a lot easier to sit in judgment and look out at other people that have made those mistakes than to look at your own faults. You know, when I read that list, guess what? I'm every single one of those people. Every single one of those people. That is me. That's me. And the good news of the gospel is those things, they don't disqualify me. They are actually the doorways that Jesus steps through. It's the doorway that Jesus comes in to relationship with us. Jesus, he moves towards the broken, but he also pulls them close. And what's the difference here? Because see, it's really easy, it'd be really easy to think about a Jesus that comes towards me in my brokenness, and he gets in the vicinity of me, but he stands back. Jesus is standing outside the yellow tape of this crime scene that's my life, and he's kind of shouting instructions. I see, you're awesome, you can do this. You got this, Billy. Right? That's not what this is. That's not what we're seeing here. We think that Jesus might just come close enough to get to get close enough to tell us what to do. That's not what's happening. You see, Matthew, he calls him from the tax collector booth. What does he do? He goes and he spends the next few years sleeping on the ground next to him, breaking bread with him, listening to his story, doing ministry with him, suffering with him. You see that hemorrhaging woman, what does he do? He lets her touch him. Jesus wasn't surprised at that moment. He lets her touch him. He turns to her. He looks her in the eye. He touches her. You see the people at the dinner table that are the sinners. You see all of these things. The lifeless little girl who he took her hand, making him ceremonially unclean. See, those areas that disqualified each of those people, Jesus stepped into those places, and he didn't just step in the vicinity of those places. He grabbed them in those places, and he pulled them close. He got in there. He got close enough so he could get some on him. Where is that for you? Where is that for us? You don't have to answer, but as you sit and you reflect in your own heart, where does Jesus take you by the hand? Because he came to do it. He went well out of his way to do this. In your broken marriage, or maybe the estranged child, or where your life ended you didn't think it should be, or where it's going, or whatever it is. Pick a card. We all have something. But that's where Jesus comes. The hard thing about that is that in order to see where Jesus moves in those places, guess what? I got to look at those places in my own life. And sometimes I like halos on tight, and I'm like hiding those things. You know what I like to do? I'm not just hiding it from you. I'm hiding it from me. Because it's hard for me to look at sometimes. So Jesus moved towards the broken. He pulls us close. And he rewrites their story. This is where it gets good. You see, when in those days, again, you keep hearing the phrase I've said over and over again, clean and unclean. Everything about that culture and their religion was about avoiding unclean things. I couldn't touch anything unclean, or I couldn't go into the temple. I couldn't do those things. But what you see in these places is that Jesus steps in and he makes unclean things clean. He steps in and he touches the hemorrhaging woman. He raises the little girl from the dead and breathes life where there is death. The tax collector that Jesus called, the tax collector that became one of Jesus' best friends. That's what the gospel does. It makes unclean things clean. And I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine that you lived back then, and about 20 years later, you encountered that hemorrhaging woman, or you encountered that little girl, and you said, "Hey, what's your name? Tell me your story." What do you think they led with? "I'm the hemorrhaging woman. I was the woman that for 12 years I was bleeding, and Jesus healed me. I was the dead little girl that Jesus took me by the hand and raised me from the dead. I was the tax collector. I was the prostitute. I was the thing." In those moments, their point of greatest shame, their greatest wound, their greatest brokenness becomes the stage upon which they stand and proclaim the gospel and proclaim it loudly. The worst parts of their story became the best parts of their story, because Jesus moved. What's your version of this? Where's that place where God met you? Maybe you know, maybe you don't know. Maybe we kind of need to reflect on it a little bit. I'll tell you, it happened for me. I was 30 years old. I was living in Atlanta, Georgia. I was a professional guitar player. And I was living in an old apartment. And I was so confused and lost, and I was prodigal, and the Lord met me through some really unlikely people. And he began to teach me what it meant to be forgiven. And not just what it meant to be forgiven, that I'd been forgiven for things that I hadn't even done yet. And I promise you, there were some doozies on the horizon that were coming. And that the message of the Holy Spirit that he poured into me, that I became a new creation, and that I was an unclean thing that had now been not just made clean, but I was called holy. I was called righteous. Me? Me? What kind of sense of humor do you have, Lord? And it began to lead me deeper and deeper. And I can tell you what, I stand here today. I don't stand here to boast of some victory story, like, "And that's the way I was, and look at me now." No. I stand here today, much like the hemorrhaging woman. I was the broken man. God rewrote my story. I don't need to clean that up. I don't need to hide the apples anymore. Because I'm like, I know what's in me, so does God. Look what he did for someone like me. Man, that's a beautiful story. And that's the invitation of the gospel. Do we know a Jesus that will come and say, I see you, and I'm willing to step into that place. Not just willing, I want to. It's the reason I came. And I want to get something on me. I'm going to pull it close. And I'm going to rewrite your story. Because I know every one of you in here, just like me, we all got these crab apples behind our back, right? We got something. But because of the cross, no matter what you've done or what you're doing or what you will do, in Jesus, he's made us new things. And guess what? As new things, we always get invited back. And for that, I say, amen. It's a joy to be with you this morning.